Join us in Omaha, Nebraska on Saturday, October 7th, 2023, as I'm proud to present the most unique and important paranormal event in the United States this year, Historic Haunted Heartland Part 2, The Spirits Speak, presented live on stage at the Benson Theater in the heart of Omaha. The fun starts with renowned saxophonist from Colorado, Andrew Vogt, whose talents will help harness the psychical energy of the audience, living and deceased, to open a doorway for communication. Next, psychic medium Cindy Kaza will use her considerable gifts to invite these spirits forward to communicate with the audience in a psychic gallery reading. And finally, paranormal and occult expert John E.L. Tenney will offer his interpretation of these events and help us all make sense of what we have witnessed, as only John Tenney can. Tickets are available this summer, and I invite you to visit Necronomicast.com. Follow the show on social media for more information. Historic Haunted Heartland 2, The Spirits Speak. Brought to you by Necronomicast. Saturday, October 7th, 2023. A night that can change your life or your afterlife. From the historic Haunted Heartland of Omaha, Nebraska, my name is Brian Corey, and it is my pleasure to welcome you all to this episode of Necronomicast. My guest tonight for a late night conversation is paranormal writer, digital content producer, urban explorer, radio anorak, and hardcore day tripper, Steve Higgins. Steve is also the founder of Higgy Pop, which is the largest paranormal website in the UK. He's written a fascinating new book, Hidden, Forbidden, and Off Limits, a subterranean journey to Britain's dark and forgotten places. Now we're going to talk about his explorations of underground factories, subterranean ammo stores, and nuclear hideouts. We're also going to take the time to discuss the latest trends and theories in the world of the paranormal. And now, calling in on the Newsmaker Hotline from the UK, I'm so excited to have Steve Higgins from HiggyPop.com. Steve, how are you?
Hi, I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
I am so excited to have you on the show. I love having guests from across the pond, as they say. Just little old me in Omaha, Nebraska. I love reaching out to the international community and having guests with a different perspective of life than my own on the program. So a hearty welcome to you, sir.
Yeah, thanks very much. I mean, I don't do many things like this, and this will be my first transatlantic one anyway. So it's nice to be part of it.
Awesome. I got to know you through your website, which I read pretty much every day because you have an article pretty much every day, HiggyPop.com, yeah. One of the largest, if not the largest, paranormal themed news information disbursement outlets in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, but then a good 50% of the audience comes from the US as well. So it's very much a kind of, you know, works both sides of the pond, which is great.
Yeah, we like our ghosts over here, and so do you.
So
you have over like 500,000 unique visitors a month. Is that right, to your website?
Yeah, I mean, on a good month before, I've had something like 2.5 million, which is crazy. Admittedly, that was a few years back when there was some spikes around Halloween and that kind of thing, you know, just a big sort of tsunami of topical content hit at once. But yeah, the base level is about 500,000 page views a month, which is great.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And we'll get to the great content that you have on your website in a second. But you're also the author of a new book, Hidden, Forbidden, and Off Limits.
Yeah. So I guess it kind of quite closely relates to the paranormal, because, you know, part of the paranormal for me anyway is going out and getting to explore a really unique and unusual place. And this book's about urban exploration and kind of getting to explore those places. And there's a chapter about supernatural stuff underground as well.
Yeah. And I also love reading about like in conspiracy theories and UFOs. And not that your book is about those things, but you can't help but mention those topics when you're talking about this unique brand of urban exploring that you've documented in this book.
Yeah. And it just so happens that, you know, one of the places I visited quite a lot was sort of completely engulfed in conspiracy theories. It was a place where it was sort of our Area 51 over here, where supposedly all the reports of UFOs were dealt with, and they were doing back engineering of alien crafts and using mind-altering technology underground and all that stuff, which, you know, when I got into this as like a teenager, was just magical. But and there is some truth to it. The Ministry of Defense was using this site for some of that kind of stuff, just not the crashed UFOs and that kind of thing. But it was the focal point for investigating, you know, reports from civilians.
Yeah, you're talking about the Burlington Bunker that you detail in your book, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what's neat about that too, like I'm reading about these places in these far off lands. Now I've been to Europe 3 times. So I've been to London, did the touristy stuff. I didn't get to go in any kind of like underground exploration or anything like that. But I'm sure there's all kinds of places that the American citizens have no idea exists that are very similar to all these places that you document in your book, including the Burlington Bunker. It's just neat that you've incorporated all this history with all this mystery too. Like there's room for over 4,000 people when they designed this or built this, a place for central government where it could continue on if there was ever some kind of emergency that would necessitate that. Even the BBC had broadcast capabilities to continue broadcasting news and events in case there was some kind of calamity there. Pretty amazing that these places, which came from the old Bathstone mining areas, are in existence, and that you were able to go explore these places.
Yeah, I mean, us Brits aren't always very prepared. So when it looked like war was happening, rather than building expensive bunkers, they just kind of took over some stone quarries, because obviously at that time people were called up for, you know, national service. So they weren't working and digging stone anyway. So they just took over these places and converted them into ammunition stores and Burlington, which is the nuclear bunker. But then surrounding that, there's underground aircraft factories and all sorts of stuff. But yeah, Burlington must be like a fifth of this whole place that's underneath Corsham. So it's just like a corner of it. But that bit alone would have held 4,000 people. And that's not an exaggeration. That was, you know, the official number. It was supposed to house and staff 4,000 people, which, I mean, it would have been a nightmare. Like, I can't imagine what the conditions would be like. It wasn't really a nuclear-proof bunker. They were just hoping that there wouldn't be a hit nearby.
Right.
They did have a lot of water and food, but I think the conditions would be appalling, really. I mean, there's one government paper that I got my hands on that said the survivors are the unlucky ones.
Survivors are the unlucky ones, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you're thinking about 4,000 people in an underground cavern, even though it's huge, this undertaking, but yeah, 4,000 people, like, where do they eat? Where do they sleep? Where do they go? Where do they go to the bathroom? Where do, you know,
yeah, and I mean, hygiene. They'd be sharing beds. It'd be literally hot beds. Like, but the thing with the UK is we're a pretty small country. And if there were two air detonation nuclear missiles, so detonated above the ground in strategic points across the UK, just two would make the whole country completely inhospitable and destroy us, basically.
The UK, small, but with all these, there's numerous that you document throughout the course of the book, all these different places that are these underground structures, I guess you would call it a structure.
Yeah.
There's a theme in a book that they all have these different histories throughout time. Most of them, like I said, started as Bathstone mines. They're kind of haphazardly dug out at first just to kind of as a quarry. And then, you know, the military saw the value in them. The military used them for installations. They adapted them. And then later, even more uses came about with engineering and digging them out further and kind of shoring up the structures and putting in technology. So, like, you go through this incredible history that, like I said, in America, I'm sure there's all these places that we have no idea about it.
Yeah, I mean, you've got Site R, I think it is in the US, which is Raven Mountain, which that just sounds like, you know, that's the kind of mystery that you want. I think it's not too far from Washington, and it's probably where the president would go and that kind of thing. So it's probably the most direct equivalent to what Burlington Bunker would have been here. But very little is known about Site R. like there's, I've looked several times and there's certainly nothing publicly available in terms of images or videos at all. But then the US has still got this and you kind of know about it. So the UK must have some kind of, contingency as well. There's no way any developed country would just sort of roll over if the worst happened. There must be somewhere where the government can relocate. It's just, well, you'd hope. I mean,
yeah. Well, even 20 some odd years ago when the attacks of 9/11 happened, President Bush was flown, well, all over, but one of the places he touched down was here in Omaha. We have the Strategic Air Command, just centralized location in the United States Air Force Base. So he touched down here. So I live here and I don't even know. You hear whispers in this and there's conspiracy theories or, there's whispers of what's going on underneath Omaha, Nebraska, this part of the country. But like one of your bucket locations was also a place in Colorado that you wanted to explore.
Yeah. I mean, that's the twin site to the site, the Raven Mountain one. But that one, there's a little bit more information publicly about. Chances are that probably clones of each other. They're probably pretty similar. It's just that the role of, is it Cheney Mountain? I think I always pronounce it wrong. It was Cheney Mountain. The role of that one is a bit better known. So that's kind of where NORAD's based and that kind of thing. So it's been beefed up. Like, the history of the places here, it's been had its role changed a lot. It changed most recently after 9/11. And it's, that's still a place of massive strategic importance, but it sounds awesome. Like the engineering work that's gone into that place, they sort of basically hollowed out a mountain and put everything on suspension. So it's supposed to be pretty much everything proof. But, you drop a bomb outside and it would just wobble a bit because it's all sat on springs and the pipes are all flexible to allow the services to continue coming in without disruption and things like that. So, I think that's probably an amazing place if we ever got to see it in any detail.
Right. I really like speaking of detail, I really like the details that you have in your book when you are going and doing all these explorations. You talk about how you get into these places and you must have an ornery streak in you too, because there's like a sense of danger, a sense of that you're trying to uncover some truth, the real workings of the government, touching on conspiracy theories. But here you are, you and your friends with flashlights in hand, and you're not afraid to get dirty, and you're just kind of going through these tunnels, and you talk about how you're crawling in some places and in these long distances that you're like, I don't know how we're going to get turn around and get back. So you must have done a lot of this when you were younger, because I guess...
Yeah.
Because you're in your 30s now, right?
I'll take 30s, yeah. I'm the other side of 40 now.
Oh, okay. Good for you.
but yeah, I mean, a lot of the places I probably wouldn't fit in anymore. It's the truth, actually. we managed to wriggle through some tiny little holes. And the crawl you mentioned, that was just horrendous. It was sort of half an hour on our stomachs, but it wasn't like it was even just flat ground. It was jagged rocks. You're crawling across boulders, essentially, for... I don't know. I think it's like half a mile or something underground. And it was just hell. But you do it because of that sense of achievement and because that kind of want to explore. You genuinely want to see what's at the other end of it. And you know that some of these places people haven't been to since World War II. They've been locked up for decades. Even the people that live above them have no idea. They might have an inkling something's below, but they have no idea the full extent of what it is. So you can walk into a room that, maybe no one's been in for decades at times, which is, it's sort of the closest you can get to exploration anywhere, really, because where else hasn't been discovered other than the deepest ocean?
Right. And here you are, just armed with the handheld torches, as you call them, but flashlights, as Yankees call them, but just on your hands and knees, on your stomachs, crawling. And I was reading, I'm like, I don't see how I could do something like that. I mean, I have gone in like haunted locations and done all this paranormal investigating and abandoned buildings and things like that. But at least there's always a part in the back of my mind that knows that I'm there's a window, there's a door. I could crawl out. Yeah. I mean, I could walk out. I can go down the steps and or up the steps, and I'm out the, you know, I'm out in the front yard of the place. But when you're crawling on your hands and knees for a half a mile or on your stomachs over kind of jagged quarried rock, and you don't know if you're going to hit an end of the tunnel, that's the thing too. Mm. And you'll have to crawl out backwards. I was reading this book and I was just thinking about all the adventure movies that I saw as a kid, like how I would love to have been able to do something like that. Like after watching The Goonies or something like that, with all those underground places. So there was a little bit of, honoriness to you, but maybe, going someplace where you shouldn't be. And you talk about police officers or security guards, unmarked black cars, people asking you, what are you doing here? And, a lot of times they seem pretty friendly, but, you've had some experiences.
Yeah, I've never had any problems with them. I always found they were generally okay. They would ask you a few questions about why you're there, and that's fair enough. That's their job, to secure what is an active military base still. But we were fairly respectful. We didn't really push up on the boundaries too much, whereas other people did. I mean, there are things that I was vague about how we got in the book, because... Right. You know, when you do urban exploration, there generally is. There were some places where, you know, we found the door swinging open in the wind, but we still knew we weren't supposed to be going in there. And we'd still be dodging security cameras. And some of the places we'd done, there was security up on the ground and we'd had to sneak past them to get underground. So, but, you know, that's probably the more their problem than ours, or the security guard's problem.
What are you doing here? That's, I just think that's great. And I know like the individual, your friend that wrote the foreword to your book, he was a lecturer, or he gave talks about, extraterrestrials and UFOs. And as a young man, you were kind of enamored by him, or you felt inspiration from his stories and everything. And that's, I think it's great that you had him write the foreword to your book. What was your relationship like with him?
Yeah, I mean, that was where it all started, really. I started going to his UFO lectures. But around the time I started going to lectures, he was kind of, although they were held at, he did the lectures at these kind of local UFO meetings, he was kind of moving away from the UFOs, and because he discovered all these underground secrets. So he was more about what are the government hiding underground. And it was him who I first heard all these stories about, kind of dog walkers walking around that look like normal people, but then they'd just go through the gates and into the military base. So they were clearly undercover security people. So I followed him for quite a few years, and it was only about, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 years ago that he contacted me through my website, because I'd written a lot about underground spaces. So sort of, you know, a bit of fanboy when I got an email from him, you know, reaching out to me.
Right.
But yeah, we speak quite a lot now, and whereas I've lost some of my sense of adventure, he's got a really cool YouTube channel where he goes to some incredible places and some really, really daring missions. And he occasionally invites me along, but generally it's a no from me now. I've done a couple of organized tours with him, but that's about it. But we still collaborate quite a lot. So he's still, you know, send me locations and pictures and stuff, and I'll send him the maps I've got of these places. So we'll help each other out in that way. But yeah, it's worth checking out Secret Vault, because he does go to some really cool places. I mean, one of the ones I did with him just before the pandemic hit was a Freemasons Hall in the city I live in Bristol. And that was part of an open day, but he asked permission to film it. So he was walking around with his Steadicam for this whole tour of the Freemasons Lodge, which was really interesting. But then I kind of lost him towards the end of the tour, and the Freemasons, you know, ushered us all out. End of the day, they locked up, and Matthew never came out. He was still inside. So it was only when he uploaded the video to YouTube that I found out that he'd hidden in the building, because he didn't believe the Freemasons weren't hiding something. He didn't believe that they were showing us it all. And once everyone was gone, he wandered around the whole building, through the kitchen, through their storerooms, every single room in that building he went through, then let himself out for a fire exit at the back at the end.
See what I tell you about an honorary streak that you urban explorers have. So he wanders. Okay, what's the name of his YouTube channel? You say it's My Secret Vault?
His Secret Vault is the name of the channel. Yeah, Secret Vault. And it's a guy named Matthew Williams.
Matthew Williams, Secret Vault YouTube channel.
Mm-hmm.
stowing away in the Freemason Lodge and exploring after hours after everybody else has been ushered out. See, I like that. I like that. He's not causing any trouble. He's not vandalizing the place. He's not doing anything dastardly, but he's just trying to uncover some truth, or they got to be hiding something in here. I love it. I love it. It's great.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You know, alone in a building like that, he could have stolen alcohol from that bar, or, you know, who right. knows what else. But he didn't. He is pretty respectful. He just wants to see places. And you know, even some of the big posh hotels in London, there was one that used to be used by a government department that dealt with the UFO reports. So mm-hmm. the kind of complaints about low-flying planes and stuff like that as well. So he wanted to go and see this historic site where this UFO department was, but it's now a fancy hotel. But he just strolled in off the street, again, holding his Steadicam, walked around the whole building filming it, but not just in this kind of public areas. He'd slipped through staff-only doors and he went down to the basement. At one point, he walked through the office where the staff were counting out cash out of the safe, and he just strolls past them with a camera. But no one challenges him because he's just so confident and likable as well that he just does it. And just that confidence. Go where you want if you've got confidence.
Yeah, he looks like he belongs there. You know, who's that guy? Yeah. Oh, you know, he's always here. He's always on the ground. Incredible. I love stories like that. So yeah, you met him from his UFO lectures, but I heard in other interviews with you and maybe other things I've read that he's not so much, or you guys aren't so much so gung-ho about the UFOs, extraterrestrials anymore, or more skeptical?
Yeah, I'm quite skeptical of that now. I think Matthew's less into it than he once was. I don't know if he'd admit that himself, but he's definitely not as passionate about it as he used to be. Mm-hmm. Although I do think officially he would still say he's a believer in it, because it's, you know, what sort of gave him his platform, really. So he might be a bit more protective about it. But yeah, I've kind of got over the idea that people are getting on little flying saucers and coming all the way to Earth. It just seems a little bit unfeasible now. I mean, when you look at like the explosion of AI we've had here in just the last few months, would we really be sending vulnerable humans across space when that journey takes tens of thousands of years or whatever it might be? You know, there just seems better ways to do it. And are they really going to get spotted when they get here? You know, why are they covering their ships in lights? And if they can travel across space, surely they can hide from us once they get here.
Right. I heard somebody joke one time that, well, there's no deer in space. They're not going to hit a deer, so they don't need lights.
Yeah. But I mean, there's no reason why there couldn't be little nanobotic, you know, microscopic size, little surveillance AI alien things floating around us now. Like, it'd be very difficult to disprove that. And to me, that seems like a more logical way to do it. And I'm not saying I believe this, but it's possible.
Oh yeah. I have a hard time like throwing firm belief in one particular part of like the UFO phenomenon, because we don't know. It's kind of like ghosts. We don't know what they are. So people mm-hmm. there's eyewitnesses. Well, what are they seeing? They're seeing something, or they believe they're seeing something. Are they seeing natural phenomena? Are they seeing something like military experimental crafts? Are they seeing something supernatural? I mean, who knows? Who knows? So I don't like to say, you know, be definitive one way or the other. I do believe there's life on other planets. That makes more sense than saying there isn't to me. You know? But like I said, I don't know if they are humanoid in appearance and they're 3 feet tall and they're gray and they, you know, like to do strange scientific experiments on us on board their ships. You know, I don't know. Maybe, maybe not.
I can't remember what I heard it as well, but one really good point was that, you know, because of time dilation, you fly at the speed of light. So, you know, if you travel across the universe to go and visit a planet, it might only be 4 years for you on the spacecraft, but back on your home planet, it could be hundreds or thousands of years. And in our current climate, you know, we struggle to get the money to fill potholes in roads. So to plan like a multi-generational space mission that's going to take 800-year round trip to, you know, see its conclusion just seems beyond the realms of possibility, really. And I don't know at what point in the future a planet would ever be ready to do that. Does it ever get that advanced even?
Well, then the technology would be that much more different when they returned, you know? I
mean, well, yeah. But then that's quite a commitment as well, isn't it, to give up?
Totally. So, like I said, when I first, before I get to that, I just want to compliment you on your book again. There was a quote at the end of it, like one of the last chapters in your book, let me pull it up here. And it's just, it's a great philosophy here too. Underground exploration has always been about the journey. The people I've met along the way, the lifelong friends I've made, the rare glimpses of another time I've peeked inside of, and the forgotten history I've uncovered along the way. I love how you wrote that. And I love like your pursuit of your spirit of adventure, your spirit of exploration, and also just, like I said, just that kind of like honoriness, like someplace where you're not really supposed to go. It could be a little bit dangerous, but damn it, we're going to go in and see what mm-hmm. we can find anyway. So I just want to congratulate you on the book. I really enjoyed reading it, even though I didn't know where any of these places were. I was pulling up my map and looking like, okay, where's Bristol? Yeah. You know, I'm trying to trace all these places. And when I went to Britain, I just went to London. I've been in, you know, Ireland and Austria and other places, but just right there in the UK, just right there in London. So it was neat for me to pull up maps, and you have all these great pictures and everything, especially on your website too, of all these places mm-hmm. that you've been and explored, and just looking at all these different locations and these exotic places and these strange underground caverns. And it's a great book. It was super interesting for a guy that likes to read about World War II and also the paranormal and strange things. It was like a really nice mix of all that stuff.
Yeah, that's probably sums up my life, really, that strange mix.
Yeah. So let's go back to your website, Higgy Pop. Like I said, that's where I originally found you, and I was reading these articles and I'm like, oh, that's a good article. And then the next day I followed your page and I'm like, oh, that's a good article. Like, this guy's really writing some really interesting things. And you, it's part of it is scientific, and they're not like super long articles. They're just great bite-sized things to kind of get you thinking mm-hmm. about different aspects about the paranormal. And there's great reviews of television shows and books, and you review podcasts on there. You review just everything that's related to the paranormal, but you still kind of consider yourself sort of a skeptic too, which I think is good.
I do, but I think the reason the website works is because I'm able to understand the paranormal from kind of both sides of the argument. So although I'm skeptical, I take the time to learn why believers believe what they believe and try and grasp the logic behind it, and kind of, you know, it then allows me to, when I write, to approach it from both angles. Some stuff I write is quite skeptical. Other stuff I write might take a kind of believer's look at a certain topic. But then a lot of it, I'll try to kind of come at it from both angles and just, you know, describe the beliefs and the criticisms about whatever it might be. But I think that's the kind of winning formula, really, because if I'm just a cynic and I come in and debunk everything, then who's going to want to read it? Because skeptics don't want to read about the paranormal because they don't believe in it. Mm-hmm. So my website will never be of interest to non-believers. So it has to be of interest to believers. They're the people who are interested in the paranormal. So I can't just go in and alienate them. You know, those are the people that should be interested. So it has to be interesting to them and supportive. And hopefully the little bit of skepticism I pepper in will just help people kind of form a more balanced opinion as well.
No, that's great. I love the fact that you do have like a balanced opinion on things, because we need to constantly challenge ourselves, because if you watch especially American paranormal TV, they'll bring out some device that has lights on it and they'll say, oh, this does this. And if you really think about it, it's like, how do you know? How do you know this context, the spirit was? Mm-hmm. You might be picking up some semi-truck driver's Citizens Band radio. You might be picking up those frequencies. How do you know it's the spirit world? So you'll go into these scientific kind of discussions and you'll kind of break apart technology and, I don't know, philosophical issues too, about can a ghost see if it doesn't have eyes? I read something about mm-hmm. that on your website. Can a ghost hear if it doesn't have ears? Those are the kinds of questions that I think we need to, especially fans of paranormal, American paranormal TV, what fans of those programs need to do is really challenge their belief systems and kind of explore those options of like, what are we talking about here when we're saying that somebody's come back from the dead?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, like you say, I don't even mind fakery in the paranormal field in the name of entertainment too much. If a TV show's for entertainment and they're going on and faking stuff and saying, is this paranormal? We don't know. Make your own mind up. That doesn't bother me too much. But it's like you say, when a team comes on and says, this is 100% proof of the paranormal, you know, this is a class A apparition, or, you know, it's not. You have no proof to say that. And letting people make their own mind up in a piece of entertainment is one thing, but passing something off as fact when really you have no basis to do that is the kind of thing that really gets to me. And, you know, to prove this isn't me being hypocritical, I saw what I would describe as a ghost last year, probably about a year ago now, actually. And even after seeing that, I would say I saw something I couldn't explain. And I would say that what I saw is what someone else would describe a ghost as a ghost. You know, it's consistent with what a ghost sighting is. But even still, I wouldn't say to me it was proof that it was the spirit of a dead person walking through that building. I just saw something that I couldn't explain at the end of the day. And
what did you see?
Come on, you're itching to ask.
I am. Look at me. I'm like jumping out of my skin here. So like, set the scene. Like, where were you at? What time of day or night? Like, what were you doing at the time?
So it was, I was on a ghost hunt. So potentially I was a bit primed for that kind of thing. But it was in a place called Woodchester Mansion, which is an old house that is kind of someone's dream house, a mansion out in the middle of nowhere that they started building. And for unknown reasons, family disputes, whatever it might be, the workmen just downed their tools and the house was never finished. So it's this really ornate Gothic mansion that's just never been completely finished. So it's kind of got an eerie feel about it anyway. And we were being shown around. It was a public ghost hunting event, and we were being shown around the property before we kind of, you know, torches out and the flashlights out and started the investigation. And I was stood at this T-junction, so this kind of tunnel going off, corridor going off to my left and right, and a tunnel straight ahead of me. And just in front of my eyes, about halfway along that corridor, a grey mass faded into my the center of my vision, stayed there for about 3 to 5 seconds and then faded out again. And it looked like someone with a sheet over them. It was like almost like that kind of, it had a very vague human figure, sort of shoulders, but not really. But it looked like a crumpled sheet, like, you know, just a heavily sort of folded and creased fabric draping. Now, I wouldn't have described that as a grey monk or a man in grey or anything like that. But having reported it to the people who run that location, they said, well, people have seen someone in grey robes in that corridor before. So in hindsight, I can then see how what I saw at the very least could be mistaken for someone wearing grey robes. I wouldn't go as far as saying that's what I saw, but I can definitely see how someone might think that. But yeah, like I said, there's no reason. It could have been a psychic projection from someone else in the group. It could have been a moment where I've glimpsed through time. It could be my imagination. It could have been many, many things. So although I saw something, I still wouldn't say it was the spirit of a dead person.
Now I can respect that. I've been doing a lot of reading, and I just, by the time this interview with you comes out, my interview with Lloyd Auerbach will be out. I just talked to him last week, and I'm very into right now. I've been reading a lot about the psychical aspect of hauntings and poltergeists and apparitions, and how they are not something necessarily to be feared or scared of. I know a lot of paranormal television relies on tropes that are used in horror movies, and they attract a lot of horror movie fans. But this whole thing about out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences and psychical projections, like you just mentioned, is very interesting to me, and how we don't know or understand exactly where consciousness comes from in our brains. You know, our brains are just a pile of goo, but something in there is where our spirit, our soul, if you want to call it that, our consciousness, what makes us human, resides in there. And they don't know what it is or where it goes, if it goes anywhere after we die. So these concepts are sometimes a lot more interesting than just, you know, the spirit of a dead person. Like if it's a consciousness that persists after bodily death, or somebody in your group, I think you said, maybe it's their psychical projection. And it's if you really dive into it and think about it, it could be so much more interesting than just saying, well, it's a ghost, it's a dead person.
That's the thing. And, you know, I propose these other explanations, but I'm not saying any single one of them is true. I'm saying they're as possible as it being the spirit of a dead person fundamentally. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we all go week after week, we all go to these same haunted locations. Like I know you've got the various old penitentiaries there and the asylums and things like that. And we've got, you know, our staples here that people go to every week. And what's the effect of having 30 people, 40 people there every week focusing on a certain room, willing something to happen? I mean, do those people leave their mark? Could I be there this weekend trying to communicate? And actually, what the energy I'm getting come through is the guys from a month ago who were just very active and kind of, you know, left a mark, some kind of spiritual mark on that location by willing something to happen. I mean, we all know Ouija boards are questionable, but could it be a kind of group psychic, you know, telekinetic kind of experience where experience where it's the people around the table willing that thing to move so much that it does? Could that explain poltergeist activity? You know, if we're all in a room for hours on end at night saying, throw something, move something, knock on something, is it our brains coming together that makes that happen? We don't know. And I think that's as a valid theory as it being a dead person, really.
Oh, yeah. Even a combination of things, like if you subscribe to like what they call like a residual haunting, well, that could be happening. And at the same location, there could be a psychical poltergeist reaction going on too, in combination, separate from each other. I mean, there's even combinations of things and things that can be, like you said, compounded. Like I've heard of something described like there is like maybe an original haunting in a place. And then people react to that haunting. And so their surprise, their shock, their psychical energy builds upon the original haunting. So decades later, what was a simple kind of an apparitional or something like that, residual kind of a thing, is now manifested with their energy into something else. And I know we're going way off into crazy land here, but
I think you've got to, though, because I mean, if you can apply logic to the situation, then you should. And yeah. The paranormal, like I wrote an article a few weeks back that I've been working on for about 3 years because I wanted to kind of find an overarching kind of unified theory of ghosts that could explain, well, not explain everything, but kind of define some rules in which everything we experience exists. Mm-hmm. And the more you think about that, the harder it is. It's just too contradictory. I mean, like, how can a ghost throw something if it can then walk through a wall and things like that? So, you know, perhaps it can switch at free will between solid and physical, but then it kind of, you know, you kind of break your own rules then. So it's very hard to define a set of rules, but I mean, that's kind of, forget explaining what ghosts are. I think the first step is to define a set of rules that ghosts can exist inside of, really. And I don't think we're anywhere near even doing that, let alone explaining what causes it.
I was going to say, you'll never finish that book. Holy cow. If you're, or that <Yeah. article.
laughs> But it's like, you know, centuries ago, we looked at the movement of the stars and the sun around the earth, and then looking at that movement enabled us to work out why they moved in that way. And we kind of need to work out what those movements are and what those properties are before we can then look at the kind of wiring under the board, really.
Have you ever thought about writing a paranormal book?
Yeah. But it's like, who am I writing it for? Because I think it would veer into quite skeptical, because if I'm writing it about my experiences, because I started going ghost hunting, well, a long time ago, probably 20 years ago now, but mm-hmm. I started doing it regularly about 6-7 years ago. Because I thought if I go to some of the most haunted places in the country, then even if it's just on a psychological level, I should open myself up to experience some of the things that other people experience that they label either rightly or wrongly as being paranormal. But I think the more I've done it, the more I've just kind of come to the conclusion that it's a lot of misdiagnosis and and delusion in some places, but it's very little of it is even left as unexplained for me. And, you know, I don't want that to sound disrespectful because I love this genre and this field. And there are valid investigators out there who get some really good evidence. But you know, it's that kind of 10% that's unexplained that's really interesting. But so if I wrote about it, I just don't know if it would kind of devolve into this, I went here, nothing happened. I went here, nothing happened. So it's finding. And as we know, there's loads of books on ghost hunting. And I mean, potentially I could treat the gadgets better than some of those other books do. But yeah, it's finding a reason to write it rather than doing it for the sake of it. But after the last book, which took best part of a year to write, it was about 10 months, I think I'm going to give myself time off writing books until March next year now. Having said that, though, I am releasing probably a book a month this year, which is more, they're kind of more little short books based on some of the writing from my website.
Oh, wow.
But I've not shouted about them so much because I didn't want to take away from the big release, which was the underground book. So this month I released a book, which was Demystifying the Oracle, which is about Ouija boards and the kind of both sides of the belief around them. And I did some surveys and as well with that, which I got about 700 responses, and I've included all that data in the book, which is really good. And then next month is about EVPs, which will probably be out by the time this interview goes live, I'd imagine. So there is some of my paranormal writing in book form available on Amazon now.
Now, are these going to be printed, or are these printed books, physical books, or printed are these e-books?
Printed and e-books, and potentially audiobooks as well, but the process of making audiobooks is quite long, so they might appear slowly as audiobooks.
Wow, you're going to put out books about as fast as Richard Estep.
Yeah, probably not as thick as his, so...
I got a bunch of his, and I always enjoy reading his thoughtful paranormal investigations. He's very thorough, and his books are very detailed. And they're, in a lot of ways, they are just good textbooks about paranormal investigating and what to expect from them too. He's not afraid to say, "Well, we were here for a night and nothing happened."
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I appreciate that truthfulness because I have been on a lot of ghost hunts. And nothing has happened that we know of. I mean, maybe something happened in another room that I wasn't in, and when the recorder wasn't running. I mean, I don't have complete consciousness all the time of the whole entire surroundings and an understanding. I'm getting a better understanding every time I read any paranormal writer's work, whether it's good or bad. I always try and pick up something from it because it's somebody's experience if they're telling the truth. But paranormal investigating isn't cut and dried, and it isn't what TV lends itself. So I much prefer reading about paranormal stuff than watching a lot of different paranormal shows. Now, that being said, I have a lot of paranormal TV celebs on this show, and they're always ones that I find interesting or that have done good work in the field, I think. So there are some out there. Do you ever get frustrated with... Do you like American paranormal TV? Sorry.
No one's ever asked me that question so directly before. I write about paranormal TV because I know people like it. Honestly, it wouldn't be my first genre of entertainment to go to. There's some shows I can appreciate the value of them. There's no shows I dislike as such. I can appreciate the value of most of them that I've seen. But they just don't mean a lot to me because if I totally trust you as an investigator and I send you out with a camera tonight and you came back with some amazing evidence, I could totally trust that your evidence was genuine. But what I don't know is, could someone have sneaked into that building that you were unaware of? Could a window have been opened that you didn't spot? You know, without being at a location, no evidence is good enough for me, unfortunately, which might sound a bit harsh. But so I don't think TV shows can ever be anything more than entertainment to me. And the same for YouTubers and everything like that as well. I appreciate what they're doing, and I'm not saying they're all fakers, but without being there myself, I can never really validate or be confident that evidence is real, because it's not captured in a controlled environment. It's captured, especially for YouTube, it's abandoned buildings where there's, you know, windows smashed and wind flapping around the place, and you just can't account for all those situations.
Yeah, I heard a noise. Well, yeah, the building's falling apart.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly.
Well, paranormal shows that I watch and enjoy are usually the ones that have a good grounding in history. Like I'm learning about the location or the era of when the building was built or the era of the people that lived there. I always appreciate that. I appreciate investigators when they go in with kind of a thoughtful sense of investigating. Like they're not there trying to fight the ghosts. I don't like that. People that are trying to either right or wrong or understand a misconception about the people that might have passed that might be haunting. I appreciate those kinds of shows, like ones that have heart and soul and that are trying at least to convey some kind of connection to the human experience. Those are the ones I like, you know, but, you know, I'm not really too jazzed up about people trying to fight demons, you know.
I think the ones that appeal to me actually are things like the kind of one-off documentaries more so. So I don't know if you've seen Steve Gonzalez did The House Between, which was...
Well, I started watching part two, but I haven't seen part one yet.
I thought part one was better actually.
Okay.
But with that, they've got some decent evidence that, you know, as I said earlier, they don't come along and say, this is definitely paranormal. They say, this happened. We think it could be paranormal. What do you think? But there's... As far as I recall, they're not overly using gadgets that are unproven. They're using, you know, things that replicate human senses like cameras and audio recorders. And they're there to help a specific person. So it's got that kind of human element to it. But they also talk you through why they're doing it. And I think with a lot of TV shows, they have a format they stick to. And, you know, the psychic goes in the first half and does their walk around, and then the team do a walk around, and then they do their first experiment, then they do their night-long vigil, then they do a clearing at the end. And, you know, when you've got that narrative and that fixed way of working, I don't think you can truly investigate, because it might be that if you're investigating a property, for example, where objects are caught moving on CCTV cameras when the property is locked down at night, then you don't actually need to be in that property to investigate that. You just put in extra cameras or whatever and you monitor it from outside. Or if footsteps are heard, again, you don't need to be there. You just need to be trying to record those footsteps. So I don't think anyone on television really tailors any experiments to the actual property they're investigating. And I'd like to see more of that kind of people thinking outside of the box and actually thinking, here's a story. A white lady has been seen here. How can we prove it? How can we disprove it? And I just don't see that. People just go in and do the same old.
Sure. Because it has a history, a track record of bringing in X amount of viewers, you know, and so then they can charge the ad dollars for that. And, you know, thinking outside the box, I was reading one of Lloyd Auerbach's books. I don't think I talked to him about this. I should have. But he'll write about how if there's a group of people and there's a paranormal incident, an experience, different people will experience it in different ways at the same time. Some people will only hear something. Some people might see something, a mist form, and other people might have a feeling, and maybe somebody else might smell something. So like, I think those things are interesting too. Like there's such a personal experience, you know, you might smell grandpa's cigar or grandma's perfume, or you might see him in his fishing cap. You might, you know, hear a voice, you know, but it's just depending on how, what kind of antenna, I guess, you might be to some kind of supernatural experience. So
I think what's really interesting with that is that there's the condition of synesthesia, where some people will see sounds or hear colors or taste feelings. And it's kind of like miswired in the brain where, you know, to put it simply, like you associate the color red with anger. You know, it's kind of where people pick up on emotion differently or a sense differently. So, you know, if, like you say, there is a paranormal antenna in it, does it depend on how we receive it and how we're decoding that information? Because even our basic senses get it wrong sometimes, or get it right. Who knows? Like, you know, clearly we don't all experience the world in the same way.
It's amazing. And that's why I love having these conversations. And so I think it's good that you you kind of describe yourself as being somewhat skeptical, and you don't always just clearly embrace every concept or a person that presents themselves to you. I like that. And it comes across in your writing, and it comes across in your website. And like I said at the top of the program, going to Higgy Pop or following your page at Facebook and seeing what Steve's article of the day, or I don't want to put you on the spot. It's pretty much every day, but I mean, you always have some kind of, yeah, you got content on there all the time. And I always have to stop what I'm doing, take a couple minutes and read what you got. Yeah. And reading what you got on. And also I must admit that you do a great job of also supporting other people's works. You always have like a list of paranormal shows that you like. You have lists of paranormal podcasts that my show has appeared on the list before. And I thank you for that. That's really very kind of you to include me with some great shows on there. You talk about other people's books. Like, you are not afraid to share the spotlight or to highlight people that are doing things out there. It's not just about Steve Higgins. It's about what is going on out there. It's a great news site, and I really appreciate reading it and the work. I mean, it's tons of work that you put into it too.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, but it's quite enjoyable work. So it's all good to do. But yeah, I mean, I have nothing to prove, really. I don't have a paranormal team. We don't go out ghost hunting. You know, if I go out ghost hunting, it's to be with a group of people that are already doing it, and it's about their experience. So it's like you say, it's never really about me. It's about the stories of the people around me, and pretty much anyone who reaches out to me and ask me to promote whatever on the site, I'll always try to do it. That as a news site, there kind of needs to be a story there. It's very hard to just say, check out this podcast if it's been around for 5 years or whatever. And, you know, you kind of need that kind of a big episode or, you know, some kind of moment to talk about it to make it newsworthy.
Sure.
But I think it's really nice that I'm able to do that because, you know, some of the bigger sort of more mainstream podcasts will get news and press attention when they have a big guest on or they do some kind of feature, but the paranormal community gets overlooked and, you know, in that respect. So I think to be able to churn out a news story about kind of the little, what's big in our world, but small and in the real world is a really nice thing to be able to do, to just show that support and bring these things to a new audience, bring these people to a new audience. And, you know, if tagging you alongside another podcaster is beneficial to everyone because you'll share it, they'll share it, and you're kind of introducing everyone to everyone. And with all this stuff we've seen the last few weeks with the US shows being cancelled and all the drama there, you know, whether you like those shows or not, it damages the paranormal field in some ways because it's decreasing the overall amount of content available. It won't be sucking as many new people into the field, who will eventually realize that it's not like it is on television anyway, but at least it brings kind of new blood in. So every kind of little bit of loss is bad. And the more we can support and promote each other is just beneficial all around for all of us.
Yeah. I've discovered some great writers through your website. I've discovered some other great podcasts through your website. When you list some on there and I'm like, oh, I need to go listen to some of these other guys and other voices and other ladies and how they present, you know, these topics, because like I said, I'm not a be all end all with my show. You know, I am totally open to other people's opinions. You know, I might not embrace them or believe in them, but I will entertain them and I will listen to what they have to say. This podcast for me in a lot of ways is like a lab. It's a laboratory. I wonder about things. I have questions about things. I find guests that I find interesting. I invite them on the program and then I have a conversation with them. And sometimes I learn a little bit. Sometimes I learn a lot, and many times the things I learn aren't what I was anticipating finding out more about. You know, it's kind of like a paranormal experience because it's a very personal interaction for me to, to have these conversations. And I don't know how else I would have a conversation with a guy over there in Bristol. It's middle of the night over there. You know, I don't know how else I would have a conversation about these kind of topics and about vast underground caverns in the UK, unless I had a show like this, unless I had an avenue. So it's the modern marvel of technology and just age old, old fashioned conversation, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you've got to give some credit to Paranormal World for that. I mean, our ability to meet people on a ghost hunt or at a convention or whatever it might be, or on a podcast or whatever, and suddenly get into some very deep and meaningful conversations about the nature of life and existence. I mean, you don't get that if your hobby is fishing, I'm sure.
Oh, I'm sure over a couple of beers, those guys are sitting in a boat talking about stuff. But yeah, but we don't, you know, I'm not talking to another fisherman off in another country at this time, you know, talking about complexities of bait and things like that. But what a fantastic time. I've really enjoyed having this conversation with you, Steve. And like I said, over the years of reading your news website and now your book and now these books that you're dropping, all the time. It's great for a guy that's kind of skeptical. You've got a great paranormal content, man.
Oh, thanks very much. Yeah. Thanks for all your support.
Well, thank you for your support, everybody. It's been my pleasure to have Steve Higgins from HiggyPop.com on the Necronomicast. I will have links to his book that you can get on Amazon. I will have links to his website. And once again, Steve, thanks so much for being part of the program.
Oh, no problem. It's been great. Thanks for having me.
Well, there we go, everybody. Steve Higgins, HiggyPop.com, Hidden, Forbidden, and Off Limits. Speaking of off limits, nothing's really off limits when it comes to the content on HiggyPop.com. He writes about the things that paranormal enthusiasts and researchers and investigators should be reading about. That's his content daily. I invite you to check it out. All right, it's time to thank a supporter of the show, Chris, otherwise known as FatGinger77. Thank you so much for buying me a cup of coffee. I certainly appreciate it, and I'm putting it to good use. Thanks to all my supporters worldwide on Necronomicast. And I hope you heard that commercial at the top of the show. Join me, Andrew Vogt. He's the sax player playing right now. Psychic, Cindy Kaza, and Mr. Paranormal, John E. L. Tenney, at the Benson Theater in Omaha, Nebraska, October 7th for Historic Haunted Heartland 2, The Spirits Speak. Lots going on with Necronomicast, including next episode, episode 250, featuring from Paranormal Caught on Camera, Mr. Brian J. Cano. So excited to be welcoming Brian on the show. I'm almost out of time here. Thank you for listening. Have a great night. Have a great life. Now go get some sleep.